direct, and I co-direct here on campus something called our Daily Work of Daily Lives. And this talk is one of our many talks each year in our Brown Bag series. I'm going to send around two flyers. Feel free to grab one, which talks about the entire semester. We have two coming up in April, so do look on there. Come on in. Where we're going to put you. So come on in, and we'll put out some more chairs if you do better. Okay? So next week, in this very spot, Emily Altamir, who's from the Department of Anthropology, will be talking about her field research in the Lansing Grand River assembly plant of General Motors. And that's called Putting Out Small Fires on the Shop Floor, Conflict and Compromise in the Automotive Workplace. So feel free to take one of those. Now, in the start pass around, you'll find it on the back on a couple of the rows. There were sign-in sheets. I'm going to start one up here. So you only have to sign one. So just I'm going to send those around. Thank you for signing in. It allows us to tell people that we actually exist and that now, currently going on downstairs, we're going to be doing a Brown Bag about it in the fall, is our mask exhibit. And you very well may not have spent a lot of time here with the machine. Feel free to pop the windows. I think it's going to become a greenhouse here. So feel free to check out the rest of the museum. Currently, our mask exhibit is going on, which has a number of occupational masks, as well as a lot of other cool stuff from across the world. We currently have an exhibit that we have sponsored. It's over at the MSU Law School that is called The People Under the Trees, Living Under the Trees, which has to do with migrant farm workers in California from Oaxaca, Mexico, who are working in California. It's a fabulous photographic exhibit, so please do come. Other things coming up at the end of April. We are showing the film Last Train Home, which many of you might find interesting. We are doing that in co-sponsorship with the East Lansing Film Festival. That showing is going to be open week starting April 26th. But on the 26th, we're going to have a panel discussion of issues around what it means to be a migrant laborer in, we better pull more chairs. Well, we're going to find ways to bring a whole group of chairs there to the back and put you in the corner. So, there are lots of you.
How many of you are social workers or from a social work major? Raise your hand. Wow, okay. History? Anybody from Detroit? Okay, that's good. How many of you are from Michigan? That was a trick question. You guys are getting a workout today.
So today, our speaker, Cynthia Edmonds-Cady, is from the School of Social Work at Illinois State University. But Cynthia finished her degree here, So it's really a return to campus for her. So we're very, very happy to have her come. And I have to tell you that I was very fired up about getting this specific talk in this year's series because the fact that we emphasize the connection between culture and work. Well, part of that is not only about working, it's also about not working. And there was a tension that came out before many of you were born about this whole notion of work versus welfare, as if it was an active choice that people were making. That many times it was the idea that there were so many people who were choosing to be on welfare rather than work. And this became, I think, a critical tension in relation to people's organizations around poverty. And it often pitted poor people against working people from the point of view that there were a variety of kind of programs that were designed to get people into the workforce, and the idea was, were these going to be taking people's jobs? Were they going to be taking a lot of the tension that you're now seeing around issues of private versus public sector is being played out in places like Wisconsin, or often fueled by a kind of a political right wing, goes back to some of those early days of their welfare rights organization. And one thing that's very curious historically is that Flower and Piven have always pointed out that the interesting thing about unemployed workers' movements or welfare rights movements is that people are really trying to work themselves out of a movement. You don't want to be unemployed, you want to be employed. So suddenly your base of people that you're organizing falls through the floor. Same thing is true in terms of welfare rights organizations. Many people who are really struggling to get off of welfare, the last thing they want to do is to continue to be perhaps part of that movement. They don't want to have to be part of a movement that's really about welfare rights. They want to be employed, off welfare, and carrying on with their lives. So I was very fired up to have Cynthia come back to campus and talk today on defining welfare, work, and motherhood, women's participation in the welfare rights movement in Detroit, 1964 to 1972. So please help me in welcoming her back down the chute.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, first I want to say for those of you who are students that when you graduate and you leave and then you come back, you forget where everything is. Because I was wandering around campus going, oh, where is the student union? Oh, yeah. So just be prepared. How many of you have read about, heard about, or even remember what the welfare rights movement was? Anybody? Okay, just a few. It's not a very well-known social movement. A lot of my work has focused on bringing the welfare rights movement front and center in our discussion of social activism, of social movement work within history, within social work, within social welfare, and particularly bringing the women who were at the forefront of that movement, bringing their stories to light. So this is part of a bigger piece of work that I've worked on for a long time. This particular larger discussion will be part of a book eventually, but I've had a couple of journal articles published off of it, and I'm continuing to go back to the archives and dig up more things. I've done archival research, so I've looked at several different archives and documents, and I've also done oral history interviews with women who were actual participants and members of that movement, particularly focused on the Detroit area. So for today, I'm going to kind of mostly emphasize this discussion or this sort of question about what is work, what really is work. And so we're going back in time to before the women's movement of the 1970s really took off. And so this question of motherhood, work, women in the workplace who were also mothers was still something that, you know, was not necessarily the norm. And so we're looking at this movement, and we're looking at how the women who participated in this movement defined work, and then we're looking at welfare policy, so those big structural level issues, those policies, and how they impacted these women's daily lives. So, and I have several photographs that we'll look through. This is mothers gathering at a conference in Washington, in D.C., and there's no date, but I'm estimating it that it's around 1970. And this photograph was taken by Gita West, who wrote one of the first books to talk about the welfare rights movement. And that came out in 1981. And this shows women, these are all poor mothers who were part of this national welfare rights movement, gathering at one of the conferences that happened in DC. And they would have these conferences yearly in different locations, and women would come together. So the first question is, a lot of scholars have defined the welfare rights movement as a poor people's movement. So it's really looked at only through this class lens, not really a gender lens. And so Piven and Cloward and other scholars have really sort of looked at this and defined it as a poor people's movement. But what I really want to look at is it a poor mother's movement? So there have been some more recent scholars, such as Pramila Nadison, and Annalise Orlek and other historians who have begun to look at women's participation in the social movement. But my interest has always been in looking at it through a maternalist lens. So the fact that these women were all mothers is something that I think is important. So George Wiley was the person to officially establish the NWRO. And the NWRO stands for what? Anybody know? National Welfare Rights Organization. So he was an African-American male. He was a tenured professor of chemistry at Syracuse University, but he had been very, very actively involved in the civil rights movement and had started to look at economic issues and poor folks' issues in this country. And he left his job, he left his position as a professor, and became a hardcore activist. This is what he did. He dedicated his life to economic issues. So he was obviously male, African American, and was the person to officially establish the National Welfare Rights Organization, which was the national umbrella organization. However, all over the country, just prior to this, and this was in 1966, there were women who were already forming little local grassroots welfare rights groups and organizations in cities all over the country. So it's important to point that out. Although the official national organization was started by an African-American male, there were women all over who were already starting to come together and organize. And so this really was, and the bulk of the people that were activists, who were very involved in this movement, fighting for their rights, were mothers. And the demand was for a right to a guaranteed income, a guaranteed adequate income, which in today's terms, when we think about welfare reform from the 90s and the derogatory view of those who receive public assistance, it's hard to believe that this group became so empowered in the 60s and the 70s. But they did become a powerful force and actually became a powerful lobbying force. And this is from a newspaper. The Welfare Fighter was the national, was NWRO's newspaper that they put out. And this is from 1972, and this kind of illustrates the point that I just made about it being really a poor mothers' movement, poor women. George Wiley is the man in the middle, kind of with his arms like this. Faith Evans and Roosevelt Willis, the man at the on the other end. But you can see that this is the executive committee. And these women were from all over the country in different communities, and they were all women. So, what was happening in Detroit? Why am I interested in Detroit? Well, first I have to explain that the Friends of Welfare Rights, and I'll just refer to them as Friends, were a middle-class group of women, and there were Friends groups all over the country, but in the Detroit area they were particularly active and particularly strong. They were middle-class women who were supportive of the welfare rights members, but they could not officially join and become welfare rights members and vote on decisions that the movement made because they were middle class. And so they were kept really out of the decision making. So Friends are the middle class supporters. In the Detroit area, I'll talk about the Oakland County Friends Group, which was the outlying suburbs. Those were middle class, and in many cases, upper middle class, white women. All of them married, many of them married to auto industry executives, white collar workers, and this is what they did. They got involved in helping these poor mothers. The mothers groups, I'll call them mothers groups, were those who were receiving public assistance. So they were welfare recipients. And they were the ones who could vote, who could make decisions, who really wanted to see themselves as decision-making leaders, you know, the power behind the movement. And in the Detroit area, one of the biggest, most powerful organizations was the West Side Mothers Group in downtown Detroit. And so a lot of the work that I did and a lot of the women that I interviewed came from one of these groups. So they worked together on direct action in the Detroit area. Particularly, the Friends were involved in a lot of direct action, so they got arrested alongside the mothers. They did a lot of marches to Lansing, a lot of marches to DC. They would protest in front of the welfare offices, particularly in Detroit. There was a camp-in that occurred during one period where they basically occupied the downtown welfare office on Temple in Detroit, and they were there for 4 days. And what were their demands? Can anyone guess what they were demanding, why they were occupying the welfare office? Take a wild guess. What would these poor mothers need? What could they be demanding? Money? They were demanding school clothing for their kids. So it's really, again, it's important to look at this movement through this lens of maternalism, because their children, caring for their children, that was a huge part of what the women were demanding. And they did, of course, they also demanded increases in their grants, so money was a part of it. But it was really basic daily needs, housing assistance, school clothing for their children, help for their children. And Detroit also, at this time, during the war on poverty, during the Johnson administration, offers a really great example of grassroots groups. So community action programs. These were programs that were developed through the Office of Economic Opportunity, through the Economic Opportunity Act, to actually set up these little local grassroots agencies or organizations that would help fund any local initiative. It could be issues around landlord needs, it could be legal aid. So Detroit was really seen as a leader at that time. And the Detroit's TAP, or Total Action Against Poverty program, was really a template for a lot of other cities across the nation that were now just getting these federal dollars, and they didn't know what to do with it. You know, I've got this money, how, you know, and they would send these letters to then Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh, or Jerry Kavanaugh, who was the mayor of Detroit, and say, you know, can I see how you started your program? How did you do TAP? I want to start one like that in Houston. I want to start one like that in Chicago. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, and actually, if you hang on a second, I've got a policy timeline that might help out with that. So, but I want to explain why Detroit is such an interesting place to look at. So we've got these federal dollars coming down to form these CAPs. That was happening everywhere. But we've also got a really strong friends and mothers group. So you've got these middle-class women who are very supportive, and you've got these poor women who are very active. You also have a lot of racial politics happening at the time. So white flight is occurring, as it has been occurring for decades during this period. So you've got people moving out, middle-class whites moving out to the suburbs, leaving the poorest of the poor in the city. So West Side Mothers steps in, sets up these programs, and helps these mothers that are living in poverty, at poverty level. So there was a lot of things and a lot of dynamics occurring. Also, Detroit has a very strong union involvement and history with the labor movement. So you already had people in the community who were used to activism, they were used to direct action, they had this history of the labor movement, and my argument is that really helped this welfare rights movement in Detroit become particularly powerful. And there's a photograph of, this is the Oakland County Friends Group. This is from their collection, but there are friends and mothers. They're on the bus. This is, I think, an old Greyhound bus. And they're heading to Lansing for a march that they would do every June to commemorate the birth of the welfare rights movement. They called it the Birthday March. So here's the policy timeline that I was alluding to. So if we look at the top, this represents welfare policy changes that were happening at the time. At the bottom, we've got the development of the National Welfare Rights Organization. Now, I'm looking between 1964 and 1972. So if you look at 1964, Johnson signs the Economic Opportunity Act, which really funded the war on poverty. This was the policy that helped a lot of war on poverty programs take place. So soon after that, in April of 1966, is when George Wiley founded what was then called the Poverty Action Rights Center, but later became the NWRO. So you can see that these things kind of happened around the same time. What I really want to focus on is, in this talk today, is the WIN program, which took place in 1967, and that stands for Work Incentive. program, and Nixon's FAP, or Family Assistance Plan, or program, which was initiated or proposed in 1969 and actually eventually defeated in 1972. So as far as the policies, I argue that this development of these CAPs or community action programs, the funding for those, helped fuel the welfare rights movement at the local level in Detroit. And then I also want to talk a little bit about WIN, the Work Incentive Program, and FAP. WIN was the first time, wasn't the first time, but it was a really strong work component to welfare. I mean, whenever we think of welfare policy, we think that during the 90s, you know, the work first programs here in Michigan, the work requirements. That was the first time work requirements were ever put into place with welfare policy. And that's just not true. Work components have always been at some level ingrained in welfare policy historically, and particularly when the WIN program was developed, the welfare rights movement had sort of a conflicting view of it. They didn't like the fact that it had work requirements for women who were receiving public assistance, but they liked the fact that it had funding for education and training, which could further their life, further their career, their skills. So I'll talk a little bit about how that plays into motherhood. Yes. That was during the Johnson administration, I believe, wasn't it? Yes, thanks.
So just saying, Johnson was elected in 64, Nixon was elected in 68, and served until he was bounced out of Watergate in 74.
Yes.
So those would be the two presidents.
These are the two presidents we're kind of talking about. And of course, Nixon was a Republican, so for him to propose the Family Assistance Plan was pretty historical because it was a guaranteed base income. It would have eliminated, you know, all types of welfare policy and just had this guaranteed sort of income, but it also had work incentives in it. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, this is the time period. So we're talking about the beginning of the Johnson administration, this push to end poverty as we know it, a lot of funding from the federal level coming down to the local levels, and that really coincides with opportunities for activism, or that's my argument. Okay, so work, gender, and welfare, the problem with WIN. So WIN is this work incentive program that's part of welfare policy now. So what's the problem with that? Work incentives should be good. It also had training and education opportunities. Well, for the women in the welfare rights movement, work was really defined as in the home for some women, but other women always had to work. So there's race and class implications. So for the African American women and Latinas, work was always something that they had to do historically. They never had this option that white middle class women had to stay at home, to care for their children. There was always some component of work that was a part of their lives. So this idea that now they were being quote-unquote forced to work was very offensive to many of the women in this movement. And this is Gladys. This is a quote. She's a poverty class. She's one of the mothers. So she is one of the mothers who's receiving assistance. And this is her quote. "I would let them know when I was working, I was called Mrs. Johnson. To me, I'm still Mrs. Johnson. I'm the same person I was when I was working and paying taxes. So I'm living on my taxes, not yours." And this theme of the mothers who were the poor mothers who were receiving public assistance were not married in most cases, or their husbands had left, they were on their own. The friends groups who were the middle class women who were supportive were mostly married. So this idea of Mrs., I'm Mrs., it lent them this dignity, and they claimed that dignity. I don't want to be treated as some single parent, poor woman. I'm Mrs. Johnson. That was very, very important to the poor women who were activists at this time. And it's something, again, that it's hard for us to think about now, but really at that time, it wasn't that common for women to work outside of the home. And for women to be single parents was something that was really derogatory. I'm not saying it's not now, but I think that women have a lot more opportunities, certainly, than they did during this time period. But they really claimed this level of dignity. And this last one, And why is it that I can't see the entire quote? Okay. So is there a way that I can shrink this down? Because I need to see what the rest of it says. Sorry. There we go. Wow. I have no idea why I did that. But well, let's just, for now, let's just leave it here. So this is a quote from Evelyn, who is one of the middle class friends. So she's African American, but she was middle class. And she said, we friends had husbands that were working and paying the rent. And if we worked okay, if we didn't work okay. So for them, those who were receiving public assistance, to have a job, it would be nice, but they didn't have husbands, they didn't have a backup. So the friends understood that they had this male support, and they understood that that allowed them to be able to stay home. Now again, I'm not saying this is a positive, I'm not saying this is a negative. This gave them opportunities to have choices that the poor women didn't have. They had to work regardless, so there wasn't a lot of choice in their lives as far as that goes. All right. And this is another photograph. This is from the welfare fighter again. And this kind of illustrates this idea of this being a movement of women. Women Power was the title. And the person on the microphone is Johnny Tillman, who eventually took over leadership for this movement when George Wiley resigned. And that's George Wiley with his hand up. We might be okay with the rest of it. Okay. Well, let's start. And this is another, I think I jumped ahead. I'm sorry. So we're still talking about the work incentive program, or WIN, and how it's kind of seen as an opportunity or a punishment, depending on who you ask. So there was this ambivalence with the policy, and a lot of the documents, the letters, the testimonies, both locally at the Detroit level as well as nationally, talked about this movement as, quote, forcing mothers into the workplace, unquote. But it also, within the same document, would say that it allowed opportunities for women. So you would have this same sense of, you know, there's a work requirement, I don't have a choice, I'm fighting against that, but yet some women embracing the opportunities for education and training that it provided. So there was this conflicting view of WIN. So thinking about this theme again of the intersection of work and welfare policy, and again remembering WIN sort of has both. It has this opportunity, but it also has this work requirement that was seen very negatively by the activists. The Family Assistance Plan was, when it was introduced, almost immediately the welfare rights movement, folks that were involved in the movement, fought against it. Now, they didn't fight against it because they didn't like the idea of a family assistance plan. What they didn't like was the amount. And this is $1969. So you can see the amount that was being proposed was 42.7% of the poverty threshold. Now, NWRO had their own proposal, which was 147% of the poverty threshold. And that became their sort of mantra, 5,500, you know, 55 or fight. They didn't like the $1,600 amount. They wanted more money. So they weren't opposed to having this, you know, eliminating welfare as it was structured at the time and having this family assistance plan. They weren't opposed to that at all. What they were opposed to was the amount. Now, what I found in the Detroit groups was there was a division between what the friends, the middle class women, and what the mothers thought about this. The mothers who fought against this had gotten so many gains, small gains in some cases, maybe just local gains in increasing needs grants for emergency needs, maybe increasing allotments for school clothing for their children, but they had gotten their demands met. They felt very powerful at this time. And so they really felt that they could push this and that they would be successful in getting this larger amount. The friends, however, that I talked to, they had a different view. They really felt that maybe they shouldn't have fought so hard against it, that maybe if they would have just accepted it, even at the lower amount, that it would have been a policy that would have been in place that would have offered what we call a social floor, a basic social floor for people, for poor folks. And that over the years, they could have argued for more money eventually. So there was this tension between what the friends felt and what the mothers felt. Those who were poor, who were living it through their daily lives, felt empowered by their activism and really felt like we could do this. But I think that in many cases, the friends really didn't think that, you know, they could go quite that far. And so here's another document that shows you the sort of, you know, slogan at the time that welfare rights kind of adopted, this 5,500 or fight. And that was really what they were after. So what I'm really interested in, when I look at this movement and I look at these policies that sometimes have a work component, other times, you know, offer this kind of social floor, this support for women, the view of public assistance, you know, was very negative even then. It's negative now. It always has been. But what I'm really interested in is the intersection of welfare and motherhood. So the fact that in this movement you had women who were mothers, who were fighting and, you know, conducting direct action, chaining themselves to welfare offices for things like school clothing and housing for their children. So I think that that's an interesting place to look. And again, bringing these women's stories to light is something that, for the historical record, that I'm very interested in. So this is Anita. She's a white middle-class friend. And this is kind of what she thought about. And she said, so as we began to see more women going into the workforce, again, this is during the beginnings of the women's movement at that time, we were losing the battle over why some women should not have to work. This is from her perspective as a mother, middle class, with a husband who had stayed home and raised her children. She felt that the poor women ought to have the same right as she had. And so there was this connection between friends. Now, they didn't. There was a lot of division. I'm not sugarcoating this. There was a lot of racial tension, class tensions. But the one place where the friends felt motivated to get involved was through their own motherhood. And this belief, particularly with the women that I interviewed, that they should have this right to stay home and raise their children and have the state support to do that, just like I did. That's what the women would say. And so I call it the right to be an angel of the hearth. And now you have to think historically about the race and class intersections of this. And, you know, the poor women, particularly in the Detroit area, the poor African-American women who were part of this movement, they had not been entitled as the white middle class and upper middle class women had been. They had not had the same sort of choices. They had had very hard lives. They had had to work in a variety of types of domestic work and things like that. So this idea that they should now be, that they're now powerful as an activist movement and should be able to argue for their rights to stay home and care for their children. And what they were doing, they weren't staying at home. They were working in the schools. They were working in their communities. They were what Nancy Naples has called activist mothers. They were out in their communities working and trying to transform their community, not just for themselves and their own children, but for future generations of children. So the poor women really saw that as now we're going to embrace this right that white middle-class women have historically had for decades. And it's interesting that many of the friends who were white middle-class women also said yes. And many times the friends would hear the mothers' stories. They would come to their churches in Detroit and they would tell their stories of what they had gone through, how they had struggled. And the friends would just be moved to tears and say, I had to get involved. I also had children at home, and I can't imagine going through that. So there was this kind of maternalist connection between the women, and together they kind of became this powerful force. So women's volunteerism, women's activism as work. We typically, when we think of work, we think of paid employment outside the home. And what these women thought of as work was very different. So their activist work, their volunteer work, that was something that they felt was bettering their communities. It was something that was valid. It was unpaid, but it was valid. And this first quote is from Anna, a white middle-class friend. And she says, it was a wonderful thing that a lot of women don't have today. And she's speaking here in
I think 2003 to me. You could be a serious volunteer, and if your children were home, you could do a lot of that work from home. You built networks, you got to know people. I was home with my kids for 20 years, and that was good, really good. So she's admitting, she says, I've had this opportunity, I've been able to do this, and I think that, you know, these poor women, just because they're poor, they should also have this same opportunity. And so Victoria, who was a white poverty class mother, so she was receiving assistance, she said, this is her quote, and she's referring to activism, what they did in the welfare rights movement. We did activism about just making it, being able to pay your bills, keep your utilities paid, and then we would picket for a clothing allowance for our children to go back to school. So the activist work, the volunteer work, both the friends and the mothers saw that as very valuable work. And that's one of the reasons they fought so hard for this idea of a guaranteed income. And this is another photograph. This is, again, from the Welfare Fighter newspaper. And the headline is, Welfare Mothers Battle for School Clothing. So they're getting arrested. They're doing a direct action in front of a welfare office. You see the police grabbing the mother, and they're battling for school clothing. So they were very serious. They did use these direct action tactics. And again, it was it revolved around these issues of motherhood. Live like a dog on a welfare budget. This is another photograph. This was a campaign that took place during this time by the Friends. So this is one of the things that the Friends did. They didn't have to live on the money that you would get on public assistance. They knew they were middle class. So in order for them to try to develop empathy, the NWRO came up with this idea, and this was done not just with the Detroit groups, but it was done all over the nation, for middle class families to try to live on the amount of money you would get if you were receiving public assistance. And in some ways it was really successful because many of these women, the middle class women that did this, would write letters to the editor of their local newspaper saying, I was hungry, I couldn't buy meat, I can't believe someone is supposed to survive on this amount of money in a month. So the idea was to try to develop this empathy with the middle class and to try to get them more involved in lobbying and policy advocacy for this group of poor mothers. And like I said, in some cases, it worked to some level. Okay, so welfare rights, again, through a maternalist lens. And maternalism is sometimes historically is this idea of being spurred into policy development, policy advocacy, or activism based on this need to help other children, to help other mothers. So this idea of using motherhood in that way. Patricia, a white middle-class friend, says, mothering was considered something you should do. That was your first job. And that was really the feeling of the friends at this time. They felt that motherhood was very important. Again, they heard the stories of these women and their hardships, and that's really what motivated them to get involved. And so this is Anna, a white middle-class friend, who says, so it was a short move to see that women were being manipulated around their economic security. In other words, women were in bad marriages because they had no economic options. Women were in abusive marriages because they had no economic options. And then when they moved to take the only option open to them at this time, which was state support, they were stigmatized. So it really gives you the sense that the Friends kind of understood these bigger structural issues that women were facing and how stigmatized public assistance was. And this is another photograph. This is mothers working together on flyers. And this is from the Oakland County Friends of Welfare Rights collection. And so it's interesting, the women did work together. The sense of maternalism was important. Both the Friends and the poor mothers felt that they were entitled to stay home and care for their children, and in many ways it allowed the ability to stay home allowed them to become activists in their communities, and they thought that that was a valid vocation. But there were differences. So again, I don't want to overstate and assume that the friends and the mothers got along all the time. There's a really great story in the archives of a New Jersey group of welfare rights that was meeting, and a community organizer, a white male who was a community organizer, came to that meeting, and he tells the story of how the welfare mothers who were receiving assistance were there, and the friends were there. And the mothers insisted that a screen, they were all in the same meeting together, listening to the same speakers, talking about the same topics, but the mothers insisted that a screen be set up between. It would be like if you took these sections of desk and you put a folding screen in between the two so that they would have a physical barrier between them. And he didn't understand that. He thought it was ridiculous. But it really shows in some ways the extreme, or the idea that there was a fear with the mothers who were poor that they would lose control of their movement. They knew that these friends had many more resources. The friends in many cases were much more interested in policy work and lobbying at larger levels. And so they had this fear that they would lose control. And there was a lot of tensions. And those tensions revolved around race and class issues. So I don't want to overstate and make it seem as if, you know, this was so great. But I do think the one thing that they did definitely have in common was this idea of the right to be a mother and also be an activist and be a volunteer and work in your community and get supported for it. And this is a little bit of an example of the focus that they had around motherhood. This is the Children's March for Survival, which was in 1972 in DC. And this was something that the NWRO did, and the welfare groups from around the country came. They brought their kids, the friends groups came, they brought their children. And this was really a way of framing welfare issues in terms of the children, the support that was needed for the children. We're doing this for the children. And I do want to mention that in many cases, the women who were involved in the welfare rights movement, and I'm mostly talking here about the poor women, the mothers, they did get leadership opportunities. They learned leadership skills and played leadership roles that they had not had an opportunity to do in their previous life. So this was, in many cases, the first time someone said, "What do you think about welfare policy? Come to DC and let's lobby. Let's talk about a different type of policy. Let's lobby for this policy instead." This was the first time many of them had taken on leadership roles in their community. So the skills that they got from that, I don't think can be overstated. I think a lot of women, and a lot of the women I've talked to, and a lot of the stories from the archives I've read from the poor mothers have really focused on the fact that being an activist and being involved in the welfare rights movement had really given them these leadership skills and had really empowered them in a way that we really don't see today. And so I'll kind of read this little quote. This is from a woman in New Jersey. This isn't one of the Detroit groups, but it is reflective of what I found with the Detroit groups as well. Margaret Rose, who was the chair of the Montclair, New Jersey Welfare Rights Organization, so she was a poor mother, she was on assistance, and she was being interviewed by Gita West in 1971, so this wasn't that long after her activist work, and she's reflecting on it. She says, "In the long run, it has been a wonderful experience, very rewarding. It did a lot for me. Until I got involved, I was in a shell. I stayed home behind doors. It was pure fear of facing the outside world. This experience has brought me out of my shell. Some of the other women have been affected the same way. For example," and then she mentions a woman who's going to nursing school to become an RN, "and just look where," she mentions, "another woman is today. She came out of her shell too. A lot of people are better and feel better about themselves because of welfare rights." So there was this sense, again, they weren't doing paid employment. They were poor mothers receiving public assistance, But by being involved in this social movement and being an activist, it empowered them, and many times they did go on to further their careers. And it goes back to what we were talking about with the WIN program and the ambivalence that the women felt with that. In one sense, they didn't like this work requirement forcing them to get a job. On the other hand, they liked the education and training opportunities that were there, which we don't see today with the latest realm of welfare reform. We don't see the levels of education and training opportunities that were there in the past. So they also sort of embraced that in some ways. And many of them talked about being, you know, being given a role as leader of a community group, a welfare rights group in their local community, and how important that was, and how that really helped develop their leadership skills and really make them, again, as she says, come out of their shell. So some basic concluding thoughts. Activist work was seen as work. I want to make sure that I make that point at that time, by the friends and the welfare mothers. The friends did a lot of volunteer work. They gave back to the community, and they felt that that was valid. That was important. And they connected it. They didn't see it as working or damaging their family because they felt they were giving back to their community, and it was helping their children in the long run. Motherhood as work and the gender and race implications. We have to remember where there were differences or conflict between the friends groups and the welfare mothers groups. A lot of that was due to, you know, this difference in race and this idea of work. Historically, many of the poor women, again, had already had to live through this. Their mothers had always worked, doing domestic work or farm work. So they didn't have the same options. So the friends did have that privilege that class and in many cases race gave them. And that's important to remember when we're talking about this idea of work. State support in the intersection of race, class, and gender. So this idea of, I mean, there wasn't necessarily an issue with the welfare mothers with the state supporting them. They didn't see it as the state supporting them. What they didn't like was when the state or when public welfare policy had demands or made demands on them and said, you must do this, you must do that, you must do this. Then they labeled it as, you know, the state as the man, you know, trying to hold us down. But they didn't see a problem with having a guaranteed annual income for themselves and their children. They saw it as their right and their opportunity, which that language is very different than what you would hear today, I think, demanding that right. And then grounding a lot of the work that I've done in the Detroit experience. I think that you really have to think about Detroit as being this really unique microcosm, again, with that labor history, the high rate of union involvement. Many of the people in that community had already been very active. They were used to demanding their rights. They were used to direct action as a technique. And it wasn't seen as something so strange. And I think it helped support that movement in the Detroit area. And I've got another little photograph here. This was one of the little handouts that they would give. Again, trying to attract new members. Although there was some animosity between the middle class supporters and the poverty class mothers, they were aware, the national movement was aware, that they needed a broader base and they needed to attract more people. So they had the slogan of join the struggle for adequate income, dignity, justice, and democracy. Link up. And that was their icon was two links of a chain linked together, linking up with the welfare rights organization. And I'll close, since I do have a little bit of time left. I saved it because I wasn't sure if I'd have time, with a quote from a woman from Pontiac who was poor. And she talks about sort of her view of welfare policy and not giving her enough support and how she viewed it. My name is Jocelyn Hubbard of Pontiac, Michigan. I'm an ADC mother of six children and the wife of an incapacitated husband. I'm a licensed practical nurse working at the Oakland County Hospital. I'm attending classes at my own expense at Oakland Community College. And this is 1972. I am also chairman of the Southeast Welfare Rights Organization. I'm an expert on poverty. I have been poor all my life. I was born poor and black, and unless things change a lot in this country, I'm going to die the same way. Every day I live with this knowledge. Every day I see, feel, taste, smell, and touch the poverty of my people and my community. Every day I live with the knowledge that you want us poor, just in case you need your bedpans emptied, your shirts ironed, your yards mowed, your house is cleaned, and your children tended, and just in case General Motors should need some cheap and temporary help. You brought my people to this country to use our men for labor and our women for housework and pleasure, and little has changed. Today, my caseworker denies me, and this is her welfare caseworker she was talking about, denies me help with my college expenses because she says that I have a job skill and need no more education. I understand that. After all, who will empty the bedpans when I become a nurse? I understand what you are. I understand what you think of me. I know how you have used me and my people, and I know how you intend to continue to use us. You're paying from $6,000 to $7,000 a year to a caseworker to help me with a life that maybe she has read a book about. Also, she is to tell me how to live a middle-class life without money to pay for it. I didn't pick our economic system, but I have to live in it. And to do this, I need money. I believe that I would spend the money as wisely as you spend yours, and I would buy much the same way as you do. I also think I know enough to seek expert counseling for my problems, and if I have money, I will pay for the service. And this was Jocelyn Hubbard's testimony. Again, she's from one of the Pontiac groups here in Michigan. And this was her testimony January 17th, 1972, at a hearing on federal welfare reform legislation. So one of the hearings discussing welfare policy changes. And this came from the Oakland County Friends of Welfare Rights, a private collection. So it just gives you a little sample of what the women felt and what they were aware of. Thank you. Yeah.
Remember that 1964, the Civil Rights Act was passed.
That's right.
So prior to 1964, employers could actually deny jobs to women because they didn't want to hire them. Okay? So put that in the context of this, that this is the birth of the Civil Rights Movement. This is around the same time as the rise of the feminist movement in America. And welfare rights organizations were one of the only places where women could really predominate in leadership roles. Because in the civil rights movement and in various other movements, labor movement especially, men were all in the dominant leadership positions. So that's kind of a context.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, particularly for women of color and poor women. This was an important movement for that.
So questions that folks have, comments, questions, raise your hand, just yell them out. You're all speechless over here.
The really important part. Well, it depends on how you define successful. The family assistance plan failed. They never got a guaranteed annual income. And as we all know, welfare became more reformed as the decades went on, with more and more of a work requirement embedded within it. But our society also changed. Women had more opportunities in the workplace and for education. So there were several things. So they were successful. When I asked them this question in the oral histories, I felt it was really important, you know, for me to get a sense of how they felt about their work. They, you know, most of them thought for a minute and said, well, I guess we were successful because we really did help a lot of women. We helped a lot of poor women like ourselves to learn what their rights were, to become more empowered, and to get out there and fight. So in that sense, as an empowering piece, I think it was successful. And actually, for a time, they made a lot of gains politically, policy-wise. They really did have some success. But there were some internal problems with the racial tensions within the movement itself, as well as external factors with what was happening within the society as a whole. So they were successful at some levels. Obviously, they weren't successful in getting us, you know, this idea of a guaranteed income We don't have that, and we've had more derogatory welfare policy changes since then. So I guess it depends on how you, again, define success.
Other questions or comments? One thing to bear in mind, and I guess I'd love to simply comment on this, is that there was a real tension around the idea that women would take men's jobs. Okay, and that's the 1964 Civil Rights Act, really. This whole notion of requiring people to work. Black women had always worked. Frankly, black women had, white women, working class women had worked. But there was this whole notion that somehow work requirements would take away men's jobs. And the last thing you wanted to do was take away men's jobs and have women do them.
Right, right. Yeah, and you saw that a lot with, particularly in this area, if we think about the Detroit area, with factory jobs and, you know, well, this one, we have to hire women now. Well, what's that going to mean for my job? Or how am I going to support my family? So there was this tension. And certainly Nixon was not all pro, you know, feminist and yay, I want, you know, women to be able to support their family. He really saw the family assistance plan as for the working poor, and he saw it as an incentive in some ways for families to be supported. So in a lot of ways it was kind of a subtle push for two-parent families instead of female heads of households. So within the culture itself, there was that tension, and even the policies, and even the way the NWRO talked about work, they made a strong effort to be sure they didn't alienate working class men. They tried not to, although working class men never really did, you know, get involved in this movement wholeheartedly, probably because a lot of that gender tension.
Other questions, comments, dance songs?
I have a question for y'all. Did you learn anything today? Was this helpful at all? Good. Was it interesting or was it too boring? Yeah, so. Pushing it, right?
We talked about
the alternative motive, meaning?
When it was presented originally, the first question was, will it get rid of social workers?
Oh, yes, the animosity towards social workers. Yes, we should know this, definitely. Yeah, and social workers, we have historically taken a bad rap. We're always seen as derogatory by both the people we're trying to help in many ways and by the people that don't want us getting involved. So yeah, it was a way to sort of get rid of us.
Now, I know that people seem to be fading out, so let's give Cynthia one more quick round of applause.
Can I turn my mic?